Should Christians judge a movie by asking whether it's conservative enough? If a filmmaker isn't a Christian, can his work still reveal profound truths? And why are so many believers completely divided over Christopher Nolan's Theodicy? What if the biggest lesson from this film isn't about Homer, or even Christopher Nolan, but about the way Christians engage culture itself? Hi everyone, I'm Lenny Esposito, and in this week's episode, I'm joined once again by philosopher Dr. Owen Anderson. Now, Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey has sparked, well, some intense debate among critics, classicists, and Christians alike. But instead of asking whether the movie is good or bad, I want to delve into a deeper question. Are Christians watching movies the wrong way? Along the way, we'll explore not only The Odyssey, but how to evaluate great works of art, why so many people are talking past each other about this film, and whether an ancient pagan story can actually point us toward timeless biblical truth. That's all coming up on this Come Let Us Reason Together.
Do miracles really happen?
Why should I believe the Bible?
Doesn't science contradict religion?
How do I know that God is real?
Welcome to Come Let Us Reason Together with teacher and apologist Lenny Esposito. Come Let Us Reason seeks to train Christians in how to think more effectively about their faith and how to answer the tough questions. And now, here's Lenny.
What is a Christian to make of Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey? Now, the film The Odyssey has done quite a bit this summer, creating a lot of buzz and reinvigorating Hollywood's box office. It's also reinvigorated quite a bit of debate, both online and through standard media channels, as how we should understand and appreciate this film. It seems that most individuals who have seen it really appreciate the artistic value shot in this wide 70mm film format, and Nolan has really created something that's visually appealing. But as most things happen, all of a sudden when we talk about the content, it seems that things are starting to divide into two separate camps. Online reactions seem to fall between either lauding it, thinking it's wonderful, or despising it. And I found this fascinating. In order to sort these things out, I've asked one of my good friends, Dr. Owen Anderson, to join me on this. Dr. Anderson has been teaching philosophy and religious studies for 21 years. He's a professor of philosophy and religious studies at Arizona State University, and he focuses on general revelation, related questions about reality, value, and knowledge, and has been a fellow at Princeton University, as well as a visiting scholar at Princeton Seminary. So, Owen, first of all, welcome back to the program. Love to have you on all the time. And
yeah,
you work in Christian worldview and as well as general world religions and approach all of these things from kind of a broader level. So I'm excited to talk about this because obviously Nolan's work has moved you and it's really been making an impact. And of course, as I'm saying, you know, we're reading about it everywhere. And it's really kind of something I think that we should think through, especially those people of faith. Obviously, everybody has a take on this. Mm-hmm. But when you first saw it, what was your initial reaction? How did you approach it initially? What were your thoughts going into the film and then when it came out?
Yeah, I think that if any director, writer, producer can sit back and say, I got the whole social media world to talk about classical literature all summer, they'll take that as a win, even if half of the group didn't like the movie. But all they're doing all summer is talking about classical literature. So as I made the joke that everyone involved in classical ed should write Christopher Nolan a thank you note. And if you bashed his book, write him an apology, or his movie, write him an apology, because even if you don't like the movie, he got you talking about it, and everyone else is talking about it. And I think if we look at the sales this summer from Amazon and Audible for The Odyssey, they're going to go through the roof of the actual book because people are going to say, oh, I want to go back and read that. But I went into the movie with a terrible attitude. I went in having seen all the news about how this is just going to be a woke DEI sermon. And I was not happy. I wasn't even sure I wanted to go. And I know the actors like Matt Damon and Anne Hathaway are super leftist and I don't want to sit through 3 hours of watching them. But within the first 5 minutes, I'm very thankful I was able to recalibrate. I saw, wait a minute, something great's going on in this movie, and I need to find out what it is. And so I'm very thankful I was able to set aside my bad attitude, and I'm trying to help other conservative Christians like Matt Walsh do the same thing and say, hey, guys, you're missing something here, which is really good. Don't let your hatred of the DEI politics let you miss a work of art.
Okay, that's a great summation for a jumping into the topic. What I want to kind of do is, and if you've seen the film, if the folks out there watching have seen the film, there's a key scene where Odysseus, as he's trying to get home, is told by Circe, who's the witch on the island, that in order to make it home, he has to sail through the Straits of Messina. He has to traverse a deadly path because he has to choose to sail between the Scylla and the Charybdis. And either one poses dangers, if you remember the movie, right? One is a giant kind of whirlpool, the Charybdis, and the Scylla is a six-headed monster. And she warns him that either choice would have bad consequences. It's kind of like a no-win situation. And it strikes me that in this reaction to the film, you really have the same kind of pouring out, right? You have the people who just love it, and supporters emphasize Nolan's technical mastery, as I said, and the ability to adapt an ancient epic. Usually those folks who are supporting the film will tell you that it's heavy on spectacle. It's an ambitious film project. You're filmed the whole thing in IMAX 70mm. I wasn't able to see it in IMAX. My son saw it, and he thought that it was brilliant. You know, the battle scenes, the Trojan battle scenes and things like that were breathtaking. Production design, cinematography is great. I don't know that anybody is quibbling about the visual value of it. The set pieces look great. It's, you know, triumphant. It's huge, right? It reminds you of kind of a Cecil B. DeMille type epic, things like that. They also hold the emotional core and the performances of the actors and actresses as strong, as holding a lot of pathos, good performances throughout, intimate character moments are there, as well as the broader, you know, fight scenes and things like that. There's quiet points of contemplation, there's horror, these things like that. And of course, it is an ambitious project to try and wrap something as huge as Homer's Odyssey and make it accessible to a modern audience. And this is one of the things Nolan did say that he was hoping to do. He was trying to make the Odyssey something that a modern audience could grab their hands around, can feel, can understand. And that was his whole point. So it's been very highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and other things. And obviously, the box office has not slowed down. I think the week two, he grossed another $89 million, which is just off of the opening weekend, one of the best second week appearances of any Christopher Nolan film, which is saying something. And again, it's just awe-inspiring things like that. Ben Shapiro, who is, you know, obviously a very conservative, posted an 18-minute gushing video review of this film, saying that he writes, quote, "Nolan is unparalleled. He's the best director working today, without a doubt. He just creates iconic movie after iconic movie." And as Variety magazine reports, this was a video review that Shapiro did. But he said, "Matt Damon, he's great in nearly everything. He sort of disappears into the part in a way that doesn't in a lot of other movies." He noted that people had been commenting on the kind of woke idea and the casting, specifically the multiracial casting. And he said, "So I know a lot of people were like, oh my God, Lupita Nyong'o is supposed to look like Diane Kruger." He goes, "I don't know. Diane Kruger doesn't look very Greek. She's German." But he said that, you know, Nolan goes out of his way to explain that war wasn't really launched over Helen's being gorgeous. So anyway, Nolan loved it. But the criticisms, and the casting is just one point of that, are, as you say, focused on number one, fidelity to the original story, as well as kind of a modern Hollywood take or a modern Hollywood viewpoint seeping through. So most of the artistic critiques come from people like Emily Wilson, who just had a 1917 translation. I believe Nolan himself used Wilson's translation as his basis to write the story. And in her review, she said that he missed really the main focus of what the actual Odyssey epic was all about, right? Nothing convincing to say about time, memory, history, war, family relationships. She said she felt that it was gimmicky in structure and pairs grandiosity with superficiality. So she really hammered it. A lot of people who had poorer reviews found it more sensory and impressive than moving, felt it was a little clunky. But most of the commentary and most of the focus has been on, as you say, the idea of wokeness or cultural backlash, the idea that Helen of Troy, the woman's face who launched 1,000 ships, is played by a black woman, and Zendaya as Athena, and Elliot Page in a supporting warrior role. You know, here's supposed to be a Greek warrior who's a transsexual, you know, and critics tell us that the film's historical and cultural inaccuracy, race swapping and prioritizing contemporary signaling over the Greek epic's traditional presentation is one of the biggest problems. So that's how we see the two sides battling out. Now, you said that after you put that aside, at least the DEI stuff, you were able to enjoy it. What do you think changed your mind as you were watching the film?
Well, I started to realize, I was just thinking about, what is the story about? So as I read critics, especially conservative critics, although the Emily Watson, who you mentioned, who's the feminist author of her own reimagining of the Odyssey, 2017 feminist version, whether or not Nolan used that or not is all speculation. It was an attempt to kind of smear the movie ahead of time to say, oh, he just used this feminist version. But what I thought was just hilarious is that the same people who before the movie came out were saying it's going to be terrible because he used her book are now saying, see, she didn't like it. We should listen to her. Well, you can't have both ways, right? Either listen to her or don't listen to her. But either way, what we want to look at is, what is the movie about? So in order to do that, and this is why on my Substack I've gotten into a number of posts now about the interpretation of art. You in this case, what you ask is, what are the characters trying to do? What are their goals and how do they hope to achieve them? What are they saying is important to them? And then what challenges do they face? What's happening to them as they pursue those goals? That's just the straightforward, what's the movie about? And what I'm noticing from the interpretation from conservatives who don't like it is they're doing a couple things. One thing they're doing is saying, this must be an eighth grade book report on the Odyssey, and I'm the eighth grade teacher, and I'm taking points off because little Timmy forgot some things in the Odyssey. And so Nolan, as little Timmy in eighth grade, gets a D because he forgot these things. That's one approach. And I don't think this is meant to be a book report. And anyone who does that is setting the director, whoever it ends up being, up for a problem, because the Odyssey, I think, is 24 books long, and each book should take an hour for a poet to read out loud. So you would need 24 hours to get it all.
Yeah, I think the Samuel Butler translation is like 400 pages. I mean, it's not a small work.
No.
It's an epic.
But the other thing that they're doing is they're reading it as an allegory. It's not really about what it's about. It's about a leftist critique of immigration policy, or it's a leftist critique of American wars and war atrocities and the PTSD that soldiers have afterwards. So they're trying to make some other point, and usually they're critiquing it because it's a leftist point. But if you just look at what the movie's about and what the characters say, I think you'll find it's one of the most conservative movies you could see. And it ends with the most pro-classical education statement I have heard in any movie, let alone a blockbuster history-making movie, history-making in the sense that it was the first one filmed in 70mm, etc. So I can't believe that conservatives are missing that. But what it tells me is a lot of conservatives just aren't good at art. And I think it could be the case, especially someone who's mathematically oriented and they're good at apologetics and they're good at analytic philosophy. well, then you're going to look for a message. What's the true message in the Odyssey, rather than just how do we interpret literature and art? And to do that, we answer the questions I was posing a second ago. So what happened for me was, as I started watching it, I realized, wow, what's happening in this story is they're setting us up to explain the redemptive arc of this man named Odysseus. And there are important secondary characters like his son and wife who are also going to have to go through their own arcs. But it starts off by saying that by showing him hunting, and he twangs a bow, and that warns the boar, and then he shoots it and kills it, but not before the boar chomps on his ankle. And as his ankle is getting stitched up, his servant friend, who was at the hunt with him, laughs at him and says, "Why do you always do that? Why do you always warn the prey?" And he says, "Well, a hunt is like a fight. And basically, you have to fight fair. You have to warn the opponent. You're coming. You don't sneak up to someone and stab him in the back. That's dastardly." And so he treats prey and he treats his opponents the same way. Okay, so now we have Odysseus' standard for himself. Now, I'm going to fast forward to the end. When he's confessing, which is the climax of the whole movie, he specifically confesses this: "I turned a fight into a hunt." So you have a connection from the beginning and the end of this story. And every scene in between there takes you from the beginning standard he has to that confession, which is why it's great, a great artistic movie. There's, even though it's 3 hours, there's no pieces where you say, well, you didn't really need that to move this forward. And what it takes from here to here is what it takes for everybody. This is why it's such an important message. Every sinner has to go through the same steps. There might be variations with some particulars, but the steps start off with Odysseus doesn't remember his own sin. And a lot of people, most of us are like that. We don't even think about our sin. We couldn't call it to mind. And in the movie, Calypso's not keeping him there by magic. The movie shows he's gobbling up this lotus flower. Yeah. She has to say,
let's slow down there, pal. Yeah, I want to get to that. I do want to back up a little bit, though, and approach a couple of the critiques and maybe cast it in a different light. So because we have these two choices, it almost feels like, you know, are you the unabashed fan and there's no critique at all? Or are you the one who says that it's terrible because it's not totally faithful to the book? I want to try and see if I can split the Straits of Messina. I want to see if I can dodge.
That's what Odysseus wanted to do too.
Right. Dodge both the Scylla and the Charybdis. And let's see if we can do that. First of all, I would approach this film and the way I see it, the way I've been ruminating over it, because it is not, as you say, a book report. It is not trying to faithfully reproduce the Odyssey as the Odyssey per se, as an ancient Greek would take the epic to and understand it. One of the key aspects of epic poetry, matter of fact, I've done a lot of work on myth because I talk about the modern superhero genre, which is interesting because Nolan, of course, has a huge footprint with the Dark Knight series and all of that. And there's a lot of parallels. Yeah, there's a lot of parallels between Odysseus and the Batman character that echo through both films. But what I'm noting is that it's, you know, the ancient concept of myth was always, number one, a person of aristocracy, an Odysseus, a Jason of the Argonauts, a Theseus, Oedipus, somebody who is royalty, somebody who is aristocracy. Someone who is either A, lost their kingdom and is seeking to get it back, like Oedipus, who, you know, has a rightful claim to it, or is seeking grandeur and glory for himself. And in the actual Greek myth, the Odyssey, this is who Odysseus is. He is very much a very crafty, cunning person. You miss some of the cleverness, especially since there's no interaction and inner dialogue with the Cyclops. You know, you miss all of that stuff. That's
the point
film.
I was really going into it as a philosopher. I was really mad they cut out the nobody dialogue.
Yeah, that's
because philosophers love that one. And then also I knew they cut out the Achilles dialogue when in Hades. And I was mad about that. But as I watched it, I was like, oh, actually, I think it was done right. I think the way that he handled it was right for the purpose of the movie.
Well, and that's my, and I guess that's my point. My point is that you can't approach this as how faithful was he to the original source material, because he wasn't. He wasn't trying to be. He was trying to make a film with a point, but his point isn't the same point as Homer's original. I mean, the Greeks used the Odyssey and the Iliad to train their culture on what makes morality, what makes, and Nolan doesn't hold to ancient Greek morality. I bring up Tom Holland here. And if you read Dominion or anything like that, we don't live in an ancient Greek or an ancient Roman worldview. We live in a Christian worldview. And the ancient, as when Tom Holland continued to research and examine what those cultures looked like, how they lived, how they treated their individuals, he was aghast at how barbaric they actually were. The idea that the Spartans had a committee that would check out every newborn child, and if you weren't functional enough to become possibly a warrior, then you were tossed over the side, you know, that kind of thing. And I bring this up because some people may assume that by watching the film, they're getting a good look into Greek culture. And I'm saying, no, you're getting a good look into the tale as told through 2,000 years of Christianity.
Yeah, that's a point that's I made been, too.
I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the Law of Zeus specifically down the road. But nobody makes the same claim to say James Joyce's Ulysses. So if you look at Joyce's Ulysses, he's done the same thing, right? He's taken the story and reinterpreted it as 18 hours in Ireland or something to that effect. And we had Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, matter of fact, which is also, right? So
SpongeBob.
Odyssey. Yep. And so what you have to do is you have to take this film on its own merits. Yeah. And you approach it as a piece of art in and of itself. And one of your articles, that, in fact, I think your most recent one, you start talking about, you don't go and say, well, what was the, you know, what was the original meaning? And this always measure up to that? We see with paintings. In fact, if you look at any of the Renaissance paintings of any crucifixion scene or things like that, they're all dressed in Renaissance garb, right? That's the art. And we don't dismiss the artist for that. We, you know, oh, he's not historically accurate, so therefore he's not considered a master.
Rembrandt painted Aristotle contemplating a bust of Homer, and Aristotle's dressed like a contemporary Dutch aristocrat.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my point in this, is that I think one of the ways to parse this, to split the problem of the syllabus and the carbidus, is to understand that you have to take it in its own message. And there are 21st century conceits. I will give you that as well. I mean, Odysseus is always self-questioning. He's not self-questioning in this way, or self-doubting. He's not.
But that's not even a 21st century. I view that as a Socratic critique. What Socrates said about the Greeks. You don't question yourself. And
you don't question yourself. Exactly. I do find it interesting that on the island with Calypso, you know, it's very like therapy driven. You know, you're not ready.
See, I take
for
it differently.
And then he has the whole confessional to Penelope, and that's almost very Catholic.
No, it is.
With that screen.
Well, if you're a secular person and you're thinking about Christian imagery, you're going to probably land on Catholic stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was very confessional, because is clearly a nod to confessional booth, because she's behind a screen.
Yes.
You can't really make out her details. And with Calypso, see, I didn't take it as Buddhist contemporary therapy, because I think the main line between the two of them was towards the end, as he's about to leave the island. She accuses him of having put himself in the place of the gods to determine what is good and evil for men.
Right.
No Buddhist would say that. That's from Genesis chapter 3.
Well, and that's the other half of this, is while there are these 21st century conceits, there's also this enchantment that happens in the film that they don't dismiss the gods. I mean, they act as though that the supernatural is part of their daily life. I don't know how you could do the Odyssey well without it. I know that he struggled with this because he didn't want it to be so far-fetched that, you know, the gods were talking to themselves on Mount Olympus. So I think he did a fairly balanced job by saying the supernatural is part of normal life.
That's a really interesting part about the movie, too. Here's my take on that. I don't think the gods are in it at all. I'll tell you about Athena in a second. But the whole movie starts off with one line. At a time of apparent magic. Beautiful line. It sets up the whole movie because that's a shot, I think, at the, and this is why the conservatives like Matt Walsh may not like it, is a shot at those who are going after the Charles Taylor re-enchantment stuff. And, oh, if we just had magic like the medieval ages, life would be good. So he starts off by saying, no, it's only apparent magic. It's not real. And then the only god you would see, everyone would admit, well, the only one in the movie is Athena. However, it doesn't fit Athena. I know that she's cast and credited for that, but that might be part of the attempt to make you think harder. I think this is Cassandra. Because
I think that they reveal that at the end, that it's his guilty conscience projecting Athena upon one of the priestesses.
Well, that's what happened to young princess Cassandra. Right. She's the one who could see the future, and no one would believe her. What the Greeks did that made the gods so mad was one of them, named Ajax, assaulted, I'll just use that word, but you know what I mean, Cassandra in Athena's temple.
And so
they show two soldiers grabbing her and dragging her, and Zendaya's character. So I think that's actually his guilty conscience over what happened to Cassandra. And he feels the weight of it from Athena because it was done in the temple of Athena.
Yeah,
but those soldiers could grab Athena and drag her into the temple if that was really her.
No. So, but we do have some of these concepts flowing through.
All the characters believe it. Yeah, they're all polytheists. Yeah,
you're always going to be a product of your time. You're always going to, you know, one of the interesting things in this film, as you say, is there is a recognition that there is a general morality to which we're all beholden. There is a Christian ideal. There is a recognition that given the plucking of the bow and the guilt then that Odysseus feels for conquering the Trojans, that there is an inherent worth that all and respect that all people should be allowed to have. And again, that would not have been true in the ancient Greek culture. All you got to do is read Aristotle and Plato both say, you know, hey, people are slaves because that's who they should be. That's where they're born. So it's really clear that this is something different than that. But what's fascinating in the whole thing is, and you've put through, matter of fact, you've posted an actual arc on the journey of the soul is the way you call it. You say you have this first idea where you either forget, or I'm going to say sometimes we ignore or self-justify our sins. And then from that point, we move on to self-deception and tries to kind of approach it so that we can live with ourselves. And when self-deception may not work, when you're challenged or when part of your sin becomes too unbearable to just ignore, you try to use self-justification, and then you have confrontation.
The distinction between those two is inward focus, like how do I live with myself?
Okay.
And then self-justification is outward focus. Someone comes to you and says, hey, you did something wrong, and you say, no, I didn't. Everything I did was right. You justify yourself. So how do I live with myself, and how do I live with others?
But ultimately, and even in the story, you have this confrontation by death, you say. Where do you see that in the film? Is that the Hades scene?
So the turning point of the motion is when he goes to Hades, or he practices necromancy at this area, this kind of desert area.
With Circe.
And the dead are brought up. And I think that's the turning point for him. That's the being faced with death. It's very Genesis chapter 3, because what happens after sin, your death is pronounced, from dust you came, into dust you shall return. And so what happens there is the character Sinon tells Odysseus what a bad person he is. And it breaks through. This is the first time you see it start to break through his armor of self-deception and self-justification. And he has to face the fact that he isn't good. He turned a fight into a hunt, and it got Sinon and many, many others killed. And so from there, that turning point is what then you start to head up to the climax where he's does return home, what he has to do to go through that. He's trying to save his men, but they are liars. And so they're going to go to the island where Apollo's cows are at, and if they eat these, they're going to be killed. And he's told they are going to eat them, and they will be killed. He makes them promise not to do it, and they did it anyway. And as he catches them doing that, he says, "Didn't you think the sun god would see you?" Now, hold on for a minute. He's said more than once that he's been praying to Athena. Didn't he think that Athena would see what he did in her temple?
Yes.
So the conviction comes back on him again, over and over. Conviction comes back on him. You're not a good person. You think you are. You tell yourself you are, but you're not. You break your own standards, and you break our cultural standards. And so then as men are killed, he heads back home. He has to figure out if it's going to be a trap like it was for Agamemnon. And then the climax of all is, when he's confessing. That's when you have, you're reading through my list, confrontation with death is a turning point. And then you have this confession of your sin.
Right.
And it has to be, I do wonder.
And he has to do that in order to let Penelope know that.
And can you imagine having to tell your wife you haven't seen for 20 years, and the first thing you tell her is what a horrible person you've been? And I think, one of our friends that I talked with said that he thought the acting was flat. And I'm not a fan of Anne Hathaway. I mean, if I see she's in a movie, it usually is a bad mark for me about the movie. But man, in this scene, this just got me. Because the whole time there's these pirates going around the Mediterranean, the peoples of the sea, and Anne Hathaway and Telemachus and everybody, Menelaus, they're all
Worried about those guys, right.
And then when he confesses what she did and she gasps, "You were the people of the sea?" Bam, that's the emotional moment of this
movie. That was the payoff.
Amazing. And it's sad because some of our friends didn't see it. They thought, it's like, come on, you need more than that. Like sometimes we need such a bludgeoning over the head, we don't catch the symbolism going on. And that one was just like, wow.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast. Come Reason Ministries was created to help provide the answers to those tough biblical, ethical, and philosophical questions. And radio is just one way we do that. Did you know that Come Reason is also available to speak to your local church group, school, or club? Lenny can engage your audience, encouraging them in the truth of the Bible and the power of the Christian faith. Are you having an event or retreat? Come Reason would love to address your group, large or small, to help them hold their faith with assurance and train them to share it more effectively with others. We've spoken in many different group settings in the past on highly relevant topics such as the reliability of the Bible, evolution, social issues such as same-sex marriage and abortion, popular culture, movies, and entertainment, witnessing to the cults, being used by God, living an authentic Christian life, and much, much more. Multi-day series and one-day workshops are also available. Contact us at 866-95-REASON for information about bringing these exciting faith-building tools to your church, group, or event today. Or you can email us at info@comereason.org. The address again is info@comereason.org. Or simply log on to the www.comereason.org website.
And then from there, I think the next stage of literature is what you call the denouement. And from there, that starts with the plucking of the bow to fight the suitors. And when he does that, the action begins, which is now going to take us from the climax to the end. Right. And I think the ending is... You can't get away from the Christian imagery of the ending.
Yeah, I think that there's, and I think you made a point in that, but I'm going to save that for the end of our conversation because I do want to make a point that, one of the problems that Nolan has is because he's steeped in Christian culture, but he's not a Christian, he doesn't see some of the futility of his ending, and he kind of tries to put it all in a nice bow, but I don't know that that's as clear as what we would hope. And I think you as well said, you know, there is no salvation. There's no redemption for Odysseus. And that's the part that kind of rings, you feel like it's almost not completed. But what we'll talk about that. But what I did want to also talk about is the other moral theme running through the film that becomes almost the clarion's call. It's what the measuring stick that they use over and over again, which was fascinating to me, the idea of Zeus's law and how you don't violate Zeus's law. Now, the idea of Zeus's law in the movie is explained that it's one of hospitality, that you treat other people as you would like to be treated. And that's kind of how they actually specify it, even within the film.
It's a little different. It's not quite the golden rule, though, because what you just said is the golden rule. What it says is the justification is the problem.
Right.
Because they might be a god in disguise.
Right. I wanted to point this out. Because really, this idea of Zeus's law, and again, part of my point here is when people watch this, and if you've ever engaged with folks, and I'm sure, Owen, you hear this all the time when you talk about, well, the golden rule, well, all faiths have this idea of the golden rule. And I'm like, not really, no. What Jesus said was something actually markedly different and much grander than what most faiths teach, right? So, Elle Magazine actually had a very interesting article on this, where they interviewed two individuals, Suzanne Lai, who's a professor in the Department of Classics in the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And she also talked to Dr. Crozier, who, and I don't have his data here, but Jim Crozier, professor of director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Classics, Archaeology, and Religion at the University of Missouri. And both of them said the same thing. They said, Zeus's law actually isn't a unifying thing in Greece, especially in the period of Odysseus. There were laws, there were expectations of behavior, and these ideas were said to be of the gods, but there was no singular set of laws to which everyone agreed. And Crozier says, it's not like the kind of orthodoxy we see in the Abrahamic religions. He says that there was a pattern just to help people live. And there was an idea of kinia, which is hospitality, and Zeus was supposed the god who oversaw hospitality. But the guide for hospitality, first of all, the motivation was different. The motivation was because you didn't have hotels, you didn't have rest stops, you didn't have things like that. You would have to either ask to sleep in someone's home or you would have to sleep out in the village square. So if you think about Genesis 19, where the two angels visit Lot, right? Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, we'll sleep out here tonight. And Lot says, no, you got to come into my home because you're, otherwise it's going to be a problem. No, we'll sleep out here tonight. And of course, you know the story. That's kind of how travel worked back in that era. And so there was a mutual kind of understanding that, look, if you open your door to somebody else, they promise not to cut your throat in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. steal your stuff, and you promise not to enslave them for the rest of your life because the gods are watching, and it's almost a karmic threat. You know, you don't know what's going to happen to you next from the gods. So it's to your own benefit to not kill them, to show them some primary hospitality. And if everybody works on this kind of karmic understanding of respect, which is actually, again, as the Eastern view is, it's actually self-motivated, then we can all get along, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Whereas what Jesus says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's not karmic. That's if a person asks you to go 1 mile, go with them too. That's extra. Do it out of love, not looking for return, not doing the bare minimum just so that you won't get punished, but actually blessing people and doing something bigger. So I think that that's a really important distinction between the two concepts. And people often miss it because we hear these kinds of things even in Buddhist philosophy, right?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think that's what shows this is not a liberal movie, because a liberal would have come home and he would have said, I need to increase the size of my government to better enforce Zeus's law and make you do it. And here, the ending is he leaves the whole polytheistic world behind to go west to look for a vicarious sacrifice. Now, if you're, this is where I think the ending's perfect, because this is not a movie about Christianity per se, even though it's soaked in Christian imagery.
Right. Right.
If it would have ended with him like going in a time machine and going to the cross, it would have been hokey. But instead, what it does is it points the whole audience, it points out you've got the same problem Odysseus has. What are you going to do about it? And your culture has the same culture that the Greeks have, which is that you're currently living in a dark age where no one reads anymore. And they all watch, they all sing songs or watch TikTok. And so the audience leaves thinking, wait, was that about Greece or was that about me? And if you're an artist and you want symbolism, now I'm Reformed, so I don't think the city of Rome is uniquely in charge of Christians. But if you're right. a secular artist and you've got a guy over by Asia Minor on an island who wants to go toward Christianity, what direction does he sail? West.
Yeah, he has to go west, yeah.
Now, it doesn't have to. You could say, well, yeah, but if you're over there, what area, what direction can you sail, Owen? Maybe a little bit north, a little bit south, or a lot west. Yeah, but he could have done what Plato did. He could have gone to the Egyptians. Or he could do what the liberals of our day do and gone to Tibet and India. Instead, he sails west. And what's he looking for? Well, he says, I need a sacrifice. And it's not going to be him. He's not going to kill himself. That means it's a vicarious sacrifice. Someone, something else will die. Why? So my sins can be forgotten. That's almost directly out of Psalm 103, that my sins will be taken as far as the east is from the west and forgiven. And so he ends up with the audience, hey, what are you going to do? What will your sacrifice be?
Yeah, again, and this is a point of departure, of course, in the original myth, Odysseus gets his kingdom back.
That's why there's a huge change, yeah.
Not chased out of town. What the other interesting thing with going back to the law of Zeus is the suitors are abusing Penelope's hospitality, right? So she's mm-hmm. trying to, as a matter of fact, they make a big deal about this yeah. because Odysseus tries to tell Telemachus, hey, you can't take out these guys mm-hmm. because you'd be breaking Zeus's law.
Menelaus tells him the same thing.
Right. I'm going to have to do it, and that's so they make a big deal about this. Which there's two aspects to this. First of all, he's already confessed to being a sinner, so to speak, and now he says, "But I have to avenge myself and take this new sin upon me," which is again that's fascinating. He does pluck the bow. I will say that, but I would argue that. Isn't it interesting, an interesting reflection of today where the suitors themselves have taken that law, which is meant to uphold uprightness, and they've actually twisted it and abused it and continue to claim yeah. it, even though yeah. they're actually in violation of it yeah. because they are. So, and we see this a lot in our political discourse as well, where people say things like, yes, we have an immigration system. You can let people in. But if you take it and abuse it and then say, well, you're not being loving or kind, you know, so I do see echoes.
Yeah, well, that's if it is so supposedly an allegory about immigration, it's a conservative.
I don't know, but I can pull that. I don't know that that was in Nolan's mind.
I know. I'm not saying that it is either.
I think that's a fascinating parallel.
If it is one, like a lot of conservatives think, it's a conservative allegory
Absolutely.
About immigrants abusing the hospitality of their hosts. And I haven't
Absolutely.
Seen. Yeah, that's where it's like so good. Like, come on.
As I field questions from believers and non-believers alike, one thing has become abundantly clear. Christians must have a firm understanding of what they believe, not just so that they can defend their faith to the skeptic, but so that they can help turn the minds and hearts of the lost toward a relationship with Christ. Come Reason exists to help fulfill this purpose. We provide a non-threatening environment for those seeking answers, as well as to the body of Christ, giving a solid foundation of what Christianity teaches and why. And now, with the need so great, we are aggressively seeking to step up our ministry, both in teaching opportunities and online. That's why I'm hoping you will partner with us here at Come Reason in two ways. First, pray for us. Pray for our speakers and staff as we seek to minister to those coming to us for answers to difficult questions. Pray that God would keep His hand upon this ministry and continue to bring those seekers to us to find satisfying answers to the questions they ask. Secondly, we ask that you consider supporting us through a gift to Come Reason. The conferences, website, and other Come Reason resources and events cost money, and we can only keep them going through the generous support of friends like you. Your gift today of $10, $25, or whatever is right for you would be a tremendous help as we work to equip the believer and reach the lost. Because Come Reason Ministries is a nonprofit organization, we must rely on the support of generous friends like you to carry out the work God has placed before us. Your gift will help underwrite the many aspects of our ministry and help spread convincing Christianity to believers and non-believers alike. Please consider sharing a gift today by going online to www.comereason.org/donate and making a gift. That's www.comereason.org/donate to make a gift today. Thank you, and may God bless you as your gift blesses others. Now, back to the show.
So it is a fascinating point of view, but I will leave it like this. I won't say that that was what it was intended to be. I will say that, like all good art, you should be able to use the visual to make the point, as long as you're not doing any damage to either the original work or doing damage to the idea to which you're trying to, point to. And I think those are important aspects.
Yeah.
So in all of this, then, one of the things, again, that we see is, I think Nolan's Odyssey film is about us today. I think he's talking as much to our culture as anything else. I think it's a warning. The problem is that, for me, it doesn't have a finality to it, a resolution. Yes, they sail off into the sunset, which is almost like a Western cliche. But there is no social or cultural strictures that gives redemption within a 21st century secular construction.
Well, here's the reason that I think that happens. There's two of them. One is, it's like King Lear. It's occurring in a pagan time period where there is no Christian redemption. And so you're supposed to leave at the end thinking, oh, King Lear is going to be saved by Cordelia. This is wonderful. And then they're both just killed. That's it. Because there is no redemption in pagan Britain. And I think the same thing here is, in that culture, there's no hope of redemption. You have to leave it in order to get redemption. Then second reason is, just like King Lear, it leaves you with this question: what are you going to do about it as the audience?
Yeah, exactly. And, for me, it strikes me as, again, this is part of the paucity of the secular worldview. There's no other answer that you can actually proffer to make this all right. Odysseus, you don't want him to not kill the suitors, but at the same time, he just spent an entire film confessing how he, violates this law, and what am I going to do about it?
Well, I mean, the movie, like you and I were kind of talking about a minute ago, how the Penelope's gasp is a little bit subtle for some people. They want a more, and so I think the answers are there, just like her gasp is, but they're not bludgeoning us. So you've got to go west and look for vicarious atonement. It's a pretty solid answer. And it's not anywhere in the Greek.
Do you think Nolan was trying to convey, I think Nolan was trying to convey West in terms of, modernism, perhaps. But I don't know that he was pointing to Christianity specifically.
This is the point I made in my post. Maybe you can put my posts.
I'll link to all of them. Yeah. Absolutely.
About how to interpret art. Is one thing is, I call it Nolan's Odyssey, just as shorthand to say this, not Homer's Odyssey. But I don't mean by that I uniquely understand Christopher Nolan's thoughts, because I have never met him. I've never read his diaries about when he was making this movie. And so if someone says, well, it depends on what he meant to do, it really doesn't. The answer is in the details of the movie. So I don't think it could, with the interpretation that it means Western modernism would hold up, because the key reason that he gives more than once for going west is to find a sacrifice that will forgive him for his sins. No one believes that modern Westernism believes in such a sacrifice. That's only Christianity. Islam doesn't believe that. Judaism used to believe it at their temple, but modern Judaism doesn't believe that. Hinduism doesn't have that. Their sacrifices are more like the Greek pagan ones, which is you're exchanging something with the gods. It's only Christianity that says if you want your sins forgiven, it's going to have to be by vicarious atonement. So I think those are the details. It's right there in the movie. I'm not putting that in there.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to hear how people parse that out. Do you think that the writing, it was almost like, again, the writing off into the sunset, felt a little, that was the only part that I thought felt a little contrived, that it didn't seem to fit. I mean, you know, Matt Damon's Odysseus was morose through most of the film. He was definitely battling demons within him. And we went through all the different steps where he was trying to figure out why. But it's clear that he's almost an anti-hero, if you look at it in this regard.
Well, I would call him a redemptive hero. So he's not the victorious hero, but he's like Aragorn is the opposite. I mean, he starts out lowly, but not because of his own sins. And then he just comes back and conquers. And this is not Christ.
No.
Just because a character gets a kingdom and a girl doesn't mean it's Christ.
Well, and he's obviously sinned. I mean, that's really
But the other side really is, clear. Here's what we could do. We could do a reductio. What are the other options? If in this movie, not the book, in this movie, he'd come back, gotten Penelope, and lived happily ever after in Ithaca, then there'd be no redemption. What's the other options? He comes back, he confesses, gets the kingdom, and goes off alone or kills himself? Well, that wouldn't be any good. I think this is the perfect ending out of the options available. And even just ideally speaking, this is the ending that you would want to have. He and his wife go in search of atonement. And that's a stated reason. I'm not making it up. That's what he says in the story.
Right. So the only point left unanswered is, will he actually find it?
Yeah. Well, so I think that's what it is. It would not have been good if he, like, the next scene is him in front of a cross or something, not just anachronistically.
No, sure.
It's too heavy-handed. The way it's left, I think, again, it puts it on us. Hey, because each of us watch the movie thinks, hey, it turns out I've sinned also, and I've hurt people. How am I going to make it right? What's Odysseus looking for? Why doesn't he just go pay money to each of the family members of the people that he got killed? Why does he have to go looking for a vicarious atonement? So each of us leaves the theater thinking the same question.
Yeah, and he's. It doesn't seem that he's trying to appease Zeus.
That's what's interesting. He's leading polytheism.
Yeah, so that's the other aspect of this that's really telling, is that it ultimately, it's almost like none of the other gods really make that much of a difference, is it? You know,
is it an age of apparent magic?
Yeah.
But it's a really great apologetic against polytheism, because the gods are awful. They're selfish, brutal. The only magic in the show is horrible stuff, like Circe changing people into stuff. Her family member is a crow. Other soldiers have apparently been changed and died. And so magic does not come off looking like the Charles Taylor re-enchantment people want it to look like. It looks awful.
Yeah, I think that the idea, though, that it does take concepts of supernatural seriously, I do think that that's something that is missing in our modern culture that we need to reengage.
Well, yeah, that it's not a materialist movie either. You're right.
Right. That's a point that I think has in its favor. And again, it one of the things that we are missing is to understand the supernatural as at least something that should be possibly considered normal. That we shouldn't blink at. We've become so systematized and material driven that anytime anybody talks about anything supernatural, everybody flinches reflexively. And this shows kind of a society where that's not the case. even if those beliefs are wrong, there is something to be said for the idea that, you know, human beings are not the primal mover. They are not number one with no one to answer to. And this also comes out when you look at issues like slavery, for example, in the Bible. and they talk about the slave. Well, everybody was servant to someone. Everyone was a slave to somebody else. Even the king was a slave to God. Mm. The concept of slavery was different in that understanding and in that era than it is today. We have so much of the antebellum South that is mixed in with our idea of slavery. And that's, I mean, it's not that it's not true. But I even have people, for example, who have engaged me talking about, you know, religious wars and things like that. And I point to, well look at how the atheist worldview parses out wars. Look at the communist regimes. Look what happened in the USSR and China and Pol Pot, and right? And they say, well, you could say atheists did it, but that's not necessarily atheism. And my response is, well, wait a minute. Can you be a hedonist and still be an atheist? Is there anything in atheism that guards you against hedonism? Mm-hmm. No. You can be completely, can you be a hedonist and be a Christian? No, you're rubbing it the wrong way. Love one another as I have loved you. There's all kinds, right? The parable of the Good Samaritan. Go and do likewise. It breaks.
Yeah.
Hedonism breaks with, you talk about Christianity, but that's not necessarily the case with atheism. No, and that's not necessarily the case with Greek polytheism either.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
So, what other points did you take away from the film, or what other closing ideas did you want to?
Well, I'm going to be putting up a few more posts about, for example, is it out of place that Penelope said, "I've been on the throne"? Some people are making a big deal out of that. I think that perfectly fits well.
Well, again, that's not part of, in the original Greek. Yes, that would be that would be considered ridiculous to the ancient Greeks. But again, this is not what Nolan is trying to do.
Yeah. No. But so I'm going to do some posts like that over my Substack, which is just Dr. Owen Anderson. You'll see my face. You'll know you're at the right place.
Okay. Well, again, we'll have links to all of that.
All right. Thank you.
To the Substack. And then people can go and read them or subscribe. Make sure you get notified for additional pieces. And it's always wonderful to talk about.
Yeah, I'm glad we could talk again.
Really, really reflecting on
and
it.
And I've got my Arizona Supreme Court case is coming up on September 1st. So maybe we can talk again then or just after.
Absolutely.
It.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really interested. And there is a prior video that we'll point to that talks about Dr. Anderson's work against some of the biases that are going on with Arizona State University, which is his employer, concerning issues of DEI and how he approaches his teaching as much as how he approaches his employment. So fascinating stuff, Owen.
Well, we could talk.
Appreciate you. And we'll talk soon. All right. One of the reasons this conversation matters is because Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey isn't really the issue. I mean, next month it'll be another movie, another television series, perhaps the newest best-selling novel. As Christians, we're constantly surrounded by stories created by people who don't share our worldview. No, the question isn't whether we'll engage them. The question is how we'll engage them. I mean, if our only response is to ask, "Does every aspect align with what I believe?" then we miss opportunities to recognize echoes of truth. But if we accept every compelling story uncritically, we'll also miss the places where only the gospel provides answers. You see, the Apostle Paul modeled a better way in Acts 17 when he was engaging the Athenians. He quoted pagan poets, not because they possessed the whole truth, but because they had grasped pieces of it. He used those fragments as bridges to proclaim Christ, and that's what Christians should be doing today. Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey raises profound questions about guilt, about justice, repentance, sacrifice, and even redemption. It recognizes humanity's longing for forgiveness, but it ultimately leaves its hero searching. Ah, the Christian story doesn't leave us searching. It does tell us that the atonement Odysseus longs for has already been provided in Jesus. That's why learning to interpret stories wisely matters. Every culture tells stories. Every story reflects a worldview. And every worldview should ultimately be measured against the truth of the gospel. So I'd love to hear what you think. Did Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey change the way you think about Homer or about Christianity's influence on Western culture? Let me know in the comments below. And if you've enjoyed today's discussion, be sure to like this video, subscribe to the channel, and share it with someone who loves great stories and thoughtful conversations. Until next time, I'm Lenny Esposito.
You've been listening to Come Let Us Reason Together with teacher and apologist Lenny Esposito. Come Let Us Reason is dedicated to defending the claims of historic Christianity, one with answers for every person. Today's program is part of a larger message which is available on audio CD. You may order a copy by logging onto our website at www.comereason.org. There you will also find hundreds of articles and resources to help you better defend your faith. Or you may call us at 1-866-95-REASON. That's 1-866-95-REASON. Thank you for listening, and until next time, God bless.